Okay, now, y'all ready to get started? So here we are in chapter 4, and chapter 4 is on demand, supply, and markets. So this is the last chapter that is the an introductory chapter. Then after this, we go into strictly macroeconomics. In 202, we would go directly into microeconomics. But this chapter is divided into three parts. First, we talk about the demand curve, and then we talk about the supply curve, and then we put the two together and talk about markets. So let's first talk about the demand curve. So first of all, what is a market? A market is a place where buyers and sellers can meet, right? Like we call a place like Kroger's a supermarket, right? It's a place where you know that you can go and buy food. And a place on Wall Street in New York is a location that we can buy and sell stock. Maybe not directly, but through a stockbroker. So markets is like a meeting place. Now, what's important here, and I mentioned this before, is that in economics, if there's no market transaction, then we don't consider it. Remember a couple chapters ago I said that if we could double the birth rate of cows in America, would the supply of cows increase? Only if we brought that increase to market. Because we are not concerned with how many cows we have standing on 4 feet. What we're concerned about is what is happening at the market. All right? Another example I gave is that if you went to your neighbor and cut your neighbor's grass and your neighbor paid you, that's labor, right? But if you cut your own grass, is that labor? No, it's not. Why? Because there's no market transaction taking place. Okay? So that's important to know about the market. So what is demand? Demand is a relation showing the quantities of a good consumers are willing and able to buy at various prices during a given time period, other things constant. Willing and able. Now, what is the central economic problem? In one word. Scarcity. Now, what does the word scarcity mean? Yeah, exactly. There's not enough for everyone who wants it for free. That's when something... Now, in a free market, when something is scarce, how do we decide who gets and who doesn't get? The price mechanism. So who gets? Afford it and want it the most. And that's what these words willing and able mean. Willing says, I want it. Able says, I've got the money to pay for it. All right? Now, what is this other things constant? Well, this is another rule of the game. For example, if the price of new Cadillacs goes down by 20%, then what can we say will happen? Well, we can say that people will buy more Cadillacs, right? Technically, we would say that the quantity demand, it will go up. Now, you all agree with that? The price goes down, people buy more. Well, what would happen at the same time if the price of other luxury cars went down by 50%? Would people buy more Cadillacs because the price has gone down by 20%? Probably not. Or what would happen if people's incomes went down by 50%? Yeah. In other words, if we're going to say that people buy more as the price goes down, what do we have to assume? No, we have to assume that everything else stays the same. We have to assume that price of related goods and services don't change, tastes and preferences don't change, expectations don't change, people's incomes don't change. Now, assuming that nothing else changes, then we can say, yes, people buy more as the price goes down and less as the price goes up. So in economics, we're always making this other things constant assumption. See, that's what it means here by saying to buy at various prices during a given period of time other things constant. See, when price, now, catch hold of this, when price changes, we always assume that nothing else changes. All right? So what is a demand curve? A curve showing the quantities of commodity demand at various prices, other things constant. A curve shows us how many units will be demanded at various prices. Various prices. Price goes down, quantity demand goes up. Price goes up, the quantity demand goes down. So we're moving along a stationary demand curve as price changes. So what is a change in the quantity demanded? A movement along a demand curve in response to a change in price, other things constant. So that's just what I said. See, because there's a difference. Here you go. Here's the attendance. Because there's a difference between a change in demand and a change in the quantity demanded. Now, if I say that thing over there is a door, I mean one thing, right? If I say this here is a desk, I mean something else, right? If I say a change in demand, I mean one thing. If I say a change in the quantity demanded, I mean something else. Those are two different terms. They have two different meanings. So when the price changes, does demand change? No, demand doesn't change. What changes when price changes? The quantity demanded changes. And I'll show you some pictures of that here in just a moment. Why do demand curves have a negative slope? Well, first of all, you got to recognize that we are simply drawing a picture of what we see happening out there in the world. We look out there in the world and we observe that as price goes down, then people tend to buy more, and as price goes up, people tend to buy less. Now, if that's what we observe, if that's the way people behave, then how would we draw a picture of this? And the answer is, we would have price on the vertical axis, quantity on the horizontal axis, and we then would have a negative sloped curve. A negative sloped curve depicts the fact that as price goes up, the quantity demand it goes down. As the price goes down, the quantity demand it goes up. So it's just common sense. Now, I've warned you before from the first day of this course that your memory is your worst enemy in this course, right? You do not ever want to rely on your memory. Now, as we go through this chapter, you're going to find that if you try to rely on your memory, you get very confused. All you got to do, though, is look at the logic of it. See, it's just common sense. Like, you know, why are demand curves downward sloping? Well, if you think about it, it's just common sense. All right? Now, what does an inverse relationship between price and quantity mean? Inverse means one thing goes up and the other goes down. One thing goes down, the other goes up. If we're talking about price and quantity here, we're talking about if price goes up, the quantity demand it goes down. If price goes down, the quantity demand it goes up. That's what is called an inverse relationship. So demand curves depict an inverse relationship between price and quantity. Now, a lot of this is just definition in terms here we're talking about. Well, the law of demand simply states that people will buy more as the price goes down and less as the price goes up. Now, we call this law of demand. It's really not a law. I mean, a law is something that happens all the time, like the law of gravity. Whereas, I mean, is it possible that people might buy more of something even if the price goes up? Well, that could happen. Now, it may not happen very often, but it could happen. So this is really not a law. as we would normally think of a law. But in economics, you know, we have our own ways of doing things. And in economics, we call this the law of demand. This inverse relationship between price and quantity. Okay, so a demand schedule is simply this relationship shown on a table. Now, economists use tables and graphs to explain things. Now, what is the advantage of a table over a graph? What's the advantage of a table over a graph? The advantage of a table over a graph is that we can be more detailed with a table. Now, what's the advantage of a graph over a table? Well, we're not as detailed, but it's easier to see the bigger picture with a graph. So, which is the best? Well, there is no best. I mean, if we want to be really detailed in what we're doing, we will use a table as an illustration. If we just want to talk about the bigger picture of something, generally how things are related, then we might use a graph. So there's lots of tables and lots of graphs used in economics. Now, if we're talking about the demand curve and we're using the table, we would call it a demand schedule. If we use a graph to depict the demand, then this would be called a demand curve. Like this here is a demand curve. See, this here would be a demand schedule because it shows us the inverse relationship between price and quantity on a table. And this here would be a demand curve because it shows us the same relationship but on a graph.
But you don't have the slides out,
sure. Oh, I don't have it? Oh, let's see. How's that? Okay, well, you took long enough to tell me. okay, over there, have you been seeing the graphs, right? The PowerPoint slide? Yeah, okay, so the class over here wasn't seeing it because I had it set wrong. But anyway, now, true or false, when price goes down, demand goes up.
True.
No.
Well, maybe.
What?
Depends.
No. That's false. Now watch this. Watch this. I'm going to show you price going down. Now, does anyone see the demand curve increasing?
No.
No, demand stays the same, right? Now, the demand is that blue negatively sloped line, correct? Now look at this. I think we lost them. Are you still there over there in Dublin?
Huh? It says conference manually deleted on that screen up there.
It does, huh?
Yeah, the TV screen behind you.
Okay, well, I need help with this, I think.
I think he's right out there on the computer.
Oh, can you go get him?
Yeah.
No, thanks.
Incoming call.
Incoming.
Oh, we're good.
Oh, are we back?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So what I was saying here let me go back. When price goes down, notice here demand does not increase. That blue line did not change, correct?
That's true.
Now, when price goes down, what does change? Yeah, the quantity demanded is measured on the horizontal axis. When price goes down, the quantity demanded goes up, and vice versa. So I can't say when price goes down, demand goes up, because demand doesn't go up. What goes up is the quantity demanded. Again, you got to train your ear to distinguish between those two terms. They're different terms. Change in demand means one thing. Change in quantity demanded means something else. Now, when price changes, we always assume that nothing else changes. And when price changes, we are always moving along a stationary curve. Okay, why do consumers buy more Sprite now? What's happening here is that, I mean, if you ask me, well, how come is it that when the price goes down, people buy more? And I might say, well, I mean, it's that way because it's that way. I mean, isn't that pretty obvious to you that that's just the way people are? Well, I mean, as an economist, that wouldn't sound too professional. You know what I mean? So, in economics, we like to think of economics as a science, although it can never really be a science because you're dealing with human beings and you're dealing with emotions and you're dealing with a lot of things that really can't be equated to an exact science. But we like to make it that way as much as possible. And so what we've got here is, you might ask me, well, how come is it that people buy more as price goes down? So economists like to come up with reasons. Why is it that people behave this way? And so they came up with two reasons. And the substitution effect is one explanation, and the income effect is another explanation. So let's look at the first explanation of why demand curves have a negative slope. The substitution effect says that when the price of a good falls, consumers will substitute it for other goods which are now relatively expensive. Now, first of all, you got to recognize that most of the time people make decisions to buy or not buy or what to buy, not based on the absolute price, but based on the relative price. In other words, if you go to the grocery store and you're looking for a can of beans, and one can is, let's say, 40 cents, and the other can is 44 cents, and in your mind, they're identical, which can are you going to buy? The 40-cent can. All right, let's say 2 weeks goes by, and you're back at the grocery store, and you're buying a can of beans again, and one can is 44 cents, and the other can is 48 cents. Now, which can will you buy? The 44 cents. Well, did you buy the 44-cent can because it was 44 cents? No, you bought it because it was less expensive than its substitute. See, these two cans of beans are substitutes. You can substitute one for the other. And you base your decision not based on the absolute price, but based on the relative price. So what this explanation says is that when the price of a good falls, consumers will substitute it for other goods which are now relatively expensive. See, everything has a substitute. I mean, even above a certain price, a bicycle would be a substitute for a car. Now, it won't be a good substitute, but I mean, if the price of gasoline went up to $100 a gallon and income stayed the same, more people would probably ride bikes, right? And again, it's not a good substitute, but I mean, things normally have substitutes. So what we're saying here is that when the price of something goes down, people tend to buy more of it, because of the substitution effect. Because now it is relatively less expensive than its substitutes, and therefore we buy more of it. See, that's one explanation of why demand curves have a negative slope. Now, the other explanation is what is called the income effect. But before we can talk about the income effect, you got to know the difference between money income and real income. Now, if you're... income goes up by 10%, let's say in a year's time, and prices go up 10%, then we would say that your income, your money income, has increased by 10%. But what's happened to your buying power? Stays the same. So we would say that your real income has not changed. See, money income does not take into effect inflation. Whereas the word real in front of anything says, well, we've taken into consideration inflation here. All right? So, but here is really the key point to this concept. What determines demand? P people's money income or real income?
Real income.
Now, for a short time, we all might be fooled, right? I mean, our incomes may go up, by 5%, but prices may increase by 10%. But I mean, before we realize that, we might think we're better off. But that's not going to last very long, right? I mean, before we know it, there's more and more months and less money, and it's going to dawn on us that our buying power is less than before, despite the fact that we've got to raise and pay. Correct? So what really determines demand ultimately is real income. So in economics, if we say income, then by the rules of the game, we mean real income. Now, if I want to talk about money income, then I got to say money income. But if I just say income, then you've got to know that I'm talking about real income, because it's real income that determines demand ultimately, not money income. Okay? See, that's, it's not true just with income. It's true with anything. Let's say you put $1,000 in the bank, and the bank pays you 3% interest, but in that same time period, inflation's 3%. Now, what we would call nominal in this case, but it means the same thing as money. We would say the nominal interest is 3%. But the real interest that you earned is what?
Zero,
right? I mean, the bank paid you 3%, but inflation's 3% in the same time period. So when the bank paid you back, how much have you gained in real terms?
Nothing.
Nothing, see?
So that means it's not adjusted for inflation?
Yeah, well, nominal means it's not adjusted for inflation. See, I would say, like in this example, I would say that the nominal interest rate is 3%. But the real interest rate is zero. See, that's what's happening today. I mean, in the savings accounts, it's the interest rates are very low. And another thing about economics is that interest rates are interest rates. If interest rates go up, all interest rates go up. If interest rates go down, all interest rates go down. Now, some may go up before others and more than others, but essentially they rise and fall together. See, if the interest rate that you can earn goes down, then the interest rates that people pay when they borrow money will also go down. See, interest rates are interest rates, whether you're a lender or borrower. So, what's the real interest rate today? Well, the real interest rate today is, in most cases, pretty much zero, because it's most people are getting maybe 2 or 3%, and that's about what inflation is. Of course, why are people buying treasury bills? Bonds that the government sells at almost 0% interest.
In hopes that later on they'll something?
Well, something is the key. Something is the key word is something, right? In other words, it's safety. I mean, even people are saying is that, well, if I put my money in a treasury bill and 2 years from now I just get back the money I put in, hey, I'm happy with that. Yeah. Yeah, you're not losing your value anyway, because over the past year, how much have prices in the stock market fallen?
Well, they fall and they go up and they fall and they go up.
You know, but on the average, how much have they fallen in the past 12 months? About 50%. In other words, a year ago, if you had $100,000 in the stock market on the average, then today you'd only have $50,000. Because that's how much the market has fallen. So the point I'm making is that people are putting their money into treasury bills because they see these as safe, and they're just happy just to hang on to they're not too concerned about making a return on their money. They just want safety. So real income, as I say, it takes into consideration inflation.
Mm-hmm.
whether you're talking about income or interest rates or anything else. And so what is the income effect? Well, this is the second reason or second explanation of why demand curves have a negative slope. It says that a fall in the price of a good increased consumers' real income, making them more able to purchase all goods, so the supply and demand increases. So what this says is that if prices goes down, people's real income goes up, and therefore they will buy more. Okay? So it's two different explanations of why demand curves have a negative slope, why there's an inverse relationship between price and quantity. Now, individual demand is a demand curve for an individual. Now, in macroeconomics, we are normally looking at what is called aggregate demand, because we're looking at the economy in the large. Now, how do we get aggregate demand for anything? Well, we get aggregate demand by the aggregation of the individual demand curves. In other words, we look at person A, and we derive a demand curve for person A. Then we look at person B, and we derive a demand curve for person B. And then we look at person C, and we derive a demand curve for person C. And then for D and E and F. And then we take an average of all these individual demand curves, and we come up with what is called aggregate demand. Okay. Now, in microeconomics, we are more concerned with individual demand, especially as it pertains to markets, of course. In macroeconomics, we're more concerned with aggregate demand, or you know, the summation of all the individual demands for some particular good or service. See, market demand is the sum of individual demands of all consumers in the market. We might call it market demand, or sometimes we call it aggregate demand. Sometimes we use more than one term to explain something, although there is a minor difference between the terms. All right, what is a normal good? A normal good is a good of which demand increases as consumers' income rises. Now, if your income increased, now when I say that, am I talking about money income or real income?
Real income,
because I didn't say money income, right? So if your income increased, would you buy more of every good and service?
No.
Now, you might buy more of some things, right? But by the same token, you might buy less of other things. Like, you might buy more steak, but if you eat more steak, you might buy less hamburger, right? Or if your income goes up, you might buy more new cars, right? But consequently, you might buy fewer what? Used cars, right? See, so those things that people tend to buy more of as their incomes increase, we call a normal good. Those things that people buy less of as their incomes increase, we call an inferior good. So there are normal goods, and then there are inferior goods, which brings us to the next slide. See, an inferior good is a good which demand decreases as consumers' income rises. So what are complements? Now, complementary goods are goods that go together, like gasoline and automobiles tend to go together, or steak and steak sauce go together. You know, they're complements to one another. We tend to use them in tandem. That's what complementary goods are. Now, all this, these are terms that we're really talking about, but in just a minute or two, we're going to start using these terms to explain certain things about demand curves. So what are substitutes? Well, substitutes are, well, you can use this, or as a substitute, you can use something else. Goods that are related in such a way that an increase in the price of one leads to an increase in the demand for the other. In other words, if you buy less of one, then you tend to buy more of the other, because they're substitutes. Now, Now, all that led to this next explanation. What is a change in demand? A shift in a given demand curve caused by a change in one of the non-price determinants of demand for the good. Now, in other words, when will demand change? Now, notice here, I'm not saying quine demand, right? I'm saying demand. When will the demand for a good or service change? And the general answer is when a non-price determinant changes. In other words, if something changes other than price, then we're going to get a shift in the whole curve. Now, what kinds of things can change that will cause a shift in demand curves? And that's what we talk about next, you see. But first of all, let me illustrate what an increase in demand is. Oh, gracious. Boy, did they scare you? Now, this here represents an increase in what? Quine demanded or demand?
Demand.
Demand. See, the whole curve is shifting here. Now, know the difference between a change in quine demanded and a change in demand. So what we're talking about now is a change in demand. What kinds of things that can change other than price that will cause a shift in the whole curve? And here is a list of six things that we talk about that can cause a shift in demand. Now, the first thing is the numbers in the market. What we say is that the more people that are in the market, then there's a tendency for demand to increase. You know, why? I don't know if Kroger still does this or not, but they used to give double coupon. They used to give out coupons, and then they would come out with double coupons. But in what weeks of the month would they come out with this offer of double coupons?
The second and the fourth.
How come? Well, not just unemployment checks, but paychecks too. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, when do people normally get paid?
Second.
You know, the first of the month and the 15th of the month would be the second and the third, right?
Yeah.
Month. You know, you get paid. Okay, you get paid the first of the month. You get paid the 15th of the month. So when people get paid, what do they normally do?
They go to the
grocery store and do a big grocery shopping. Now, in the second month or the fourth month, they may go to the grocery store to buy milk and bread. But, I mean, they normally don't do a big grocery shopping. So what does Kroger's do to attract more people into the market?
So you can save more.
See? Well, yeah, so you can save more. But in what weeks are they most concerned about drawing more people into the market? The second week and the fourth week, see? Because they figured, well, the more people we can draw into the market, then there's a tendency that we'll be able to sell more. Now, did I say that the more people we have in the market, then the more demand will be?
No.
I didn't say that. What did I say?
Demand will increase?
No. What did I say? What word did I use? I used the word tendency.
See, it all depends, right?
Well, it's a little different. It's a tendency is tendency. I mean, if with more people in the market, then we can say that normally, usually, the majority of times, you know, I mean, there's a tendency here, you know, everything else being equal, even maybe, that people will buy more. But I can't say that for sure. I mean, I can't make an absolute statement that if more people are in the market, that demand will increase. So that's why in economics we always use the word tendency a lot, because we're talking about people, and people aren't always predictable, even. I mean, you know, we're dealing with human beings, we're dealing with emotions, we're dealing with change. Change can come about so abruptly, And so in economics, we, you know, we don't talk in absolute terms. We talk about, well, in this situation, people tend to do this, or in this different situation, people tend to do that, you see. And so that's the way that, you know, you have to look at this thing. So what we're saying here is that as more people enter the market, now, can you be in the market and not buy anything?
Yes.
Of course. You see, I mean, you might go to the grocery store and look for something and not find what you want, at least at the price you want to pay, and walk out without buying anything, right? So, see, not everyone in the market ends up buying. But the more people you have in the market, why are they in the market? Well, they're in the market because they're saying, hey, you know, I'm kind of interested, and if I can find what I want at the price I'm willing to pay, I'll buy it. See, that's the kind of people that are in the market. Now, not everyone, of course, is in the market, right? And not everyone in the market will end up buying. All right, so consumer income. Now, I think I got this. No, I don't. Consumer income. What we're saying here is that when people's income increase, there will be an increase in demand for what?
Goods.
What kind of goods?
Normal goods.
Normal goods. And there will be a decrease in demand for
inferior
goods. Now, notice here, again, I'm not saying that there's a change in the quantity demand, am I? I'm saying there's a change
in demand.
Yeah, I'm saying there's a change in demand. When people's incomes change, then there's going to be a change in demand. How that demand changes depends on if we're talking about normal goods or inferior goods. All right, the third variable that can cause a shift in demand curves is price of related goods. Now, for example, take a steak and steak sauce. They're related, you know. They tend to go together. Now, be careful on this one. If the price of steak goes up, what's going to happen?
The demand for steak sauce will decrease.
Oh, yeah. Well, you're right. But before we get there, the way I was getting at is, you're exactly right. But you did a good job. But the point I was going to make is that when the price of steak goes up, the quantity demanded goes down, correct?
Yeah.
But if people buy less steak, they will tend, now again, see, I'm using the word tend, right? They will tend to buy less steak sauce, correct? So what is happening to
the demand
for steak sauce?
It's going down.
It's going down. Now you see what I was getting at there? The price of steak went up. So what happened? The quantity demanded went down, but as a result, the
demand
for steak sauce went down.
So see? Does that only apply to complementary goods like that?
Yeah, well, when two goods are related, then when the price of one changes, the demand for the other changes.
Okay.
Now, how it changes depends on whether the goods are complements or substitutes. Like the example I just gave were two goods that were related as complementary goods. But like if two goods are substitutes, what would be a substitute? Like maybe ice cream and sherbet, you know. If the price of ice cream goes up, then what will people do?
Buy sherbet.
Well, for ice cream, the quantity demanded will go down. But as a result, what will happen to the
demand
for sherbet?
It will go up.
So you notice here that this is the opposite of what was true with complements. But so all we're showing here is that a change in demand will occur if the price of a related good changes. Not the good in question, but a related good changes. Okay, like steak sauce and steak, or sherbet and ice cream. All right, the fourth factor that can cause shifts in demand curves is a change in expectations. Now here we've got this is a powerful force in economics, because we are, the economy is made up of human beings, correct? And human beings are very emotional, for one thing, and very often we base our decisions not on the here and the now, but we base our decisions on what we expect to happen in the future, correct? I mean, why are you all here right now? I mean, are you here because this is more fun than anything else you could possibly do right now, and you just couldn't wait to get to, you know, this lecture? And yeah, see, you're here because you expect that your future will be better as a result, correct? In other words, you know, most of you are not here for the here and the now. You're here because, and you've made a decision based on what you think is going to happen tomorrow, correct? See, you see, so many of our decisions that we make is based on our expectations. Now, those expectations can change. And they're are a powerful force in economics. Like, for example, let's say that in the New River Valley, there was a rumor that we were going to have a shortage of sugar. Now, if people believed that, even though it wasn't true, if people believed that, what would they do?
They
would tend, again, here we're using the word tend, right? There would be tendency for them to buy more sugar. Well, if a bunch of people bought a whole lot more sugar than they normally would, what would result?
We'd run out of sugar.
And we would have a shortage. Now, why do we have a shortage?
Yeah,
we expected a shortage, so we got a shortage. See, it became a self-fulfilling prophecy. I mean, if more people think that we're going to have a growing unemployment problem, and they become pessimistic and, you know, fear sets in, what's going to happen to their spending habits?
They're going to start spending less and save more.
They're going to start spending less and saving more. So as people spend less, as demand goes down, business sells less, they produce less, what happens?
Unemployment goes up.
Yeah, exactly. So now, why do we have more unemployment? Because people expected us to have more unemployment, right? Again, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. If we expect more unemployment, then we get more unemployment. See, that's a justification for the fact that this new $800 billion stimulus bill that was just passed earlier this week, you know, it's really closer to $1 trillion, you know, increase. About 70, at least 70% of that is in the form of increase in spending. And only 30% is in the form of lower taxes. Now, what is the justification for that? Well, the justification for that is government says, you know, politicians say, well, if we just cut taxes 100%, what would people do? Well, they might spend a little more, but because there's so much fear today and so much expectations of things getting worse, that a lot of people would tend to what? Just like he said, they would tend to save more, right? I mean, they might spend a little more, but, you know, the bulk of it would go into savings. And the politician is saying, well, that's not going to help our economy. See? So instead of us lowering taxes, we'll simply shortcut it and increase spending directly, see? Now, you know, you may agree or disagree with that. I've certainly got an opinion, but the point I'm making is it's a justification for increase in spending as opposed to cutting taxes, because that's exactly what's happening today economically. People are saving more and spending less, and yes, unemployment is increasing. Now, are people's expectations the only reason that unemployment's increasing?
No,
of course not. There are real fundamental reasons, which is always the case in economics. There's never, ever just one reason for things happening. There's a multitude of reasons for things happening. See what I mean? But what we're saying here is that amongst lots of reasons, expectations is a factor. That people's expectations dictate their actions, and their actions have a profound consequence on what happens economically. If we expect more unemployment, then we tend to get more unemployment. If we expect shortages, then we tend to get shortages. If we expect higher prices in any one area, then we'll get higher prices. Like, take housing, for example. If people expect the price of houses to go up, now, is everyone in the market to buy a house?
No.
No, but there are a certain... There's a group, right, that is in the market. Now, that's not to say they will buy a house, but they're in the market. They're looking, right? Now, if more of those people expect the price of houses to go up, what might more of them tend to do?
Not buy.
No, they'll tend to buy more.
Oh, because they want to get it before the price goes
up. Exactly, because they want to get it before the price goes up. See, they might say, well, we haven't found our dream home yet, but you know, if we don't buy now and we wait, I mean, another year from now, prices of the house will go up so high that we may never be able to afford to buy a house. So let's get a house now while we can. So with more people demanding houses and there's more competition now, how, in the free market, how do we decide who gets and who doesn't get? The price mechanism, right? And what's going to happen to the price of houses? It's going to go up. Well, why did the price of houses go up? Because people expected the price to go up. Was there any other reason? No, not in this case. The only reason was, well, if enough people expect higher prices, we get higher prices. See, it all becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Expectations is a powerful force that exists economically. See, I can bring this one step farther and say, which ones of you here right now will be wealthy in 10 years? Is it those of you that successfully get a college degree? Probably not. Is there those of you that are going to work the hardest?
Probably not.
I mean, is it those of you that acquire the most knowledge? Probably not. See, what is the only thing, really, when you get down to it, that's going to determine where you're going to be 10 years from now?
Luck.
No, not luck. There might be a smidgen of that. I mean, again, remember, we're talking about tendencies here, but the tendency here is that those of you that will be wealthy in 10 years are those of you that expect to be wealthy. And if you expect to make $200,000 a year, 10 years from now, then chances are you will. If you really believe that, if you expect it and believe it, then it'll happen. I mean, there's a tendency for it to happen. Again, we can't talk here in absolutes, but if you expect to make $50,000 a year, how much do you think you end up making?
$50,000
a year. I mean, and this is just the way the world works. I mean, life happens to us in accordance to our expectations. If you expect to be wealthy, you'll be wealthy. Now here's another interesting thing. In order to be wealthy, do you have to know how to be wealthy? You're right. No, you don't. That's inconsequential. That is of no importance. You do not know. It doesn't require. I mean, ultimately, it requires knowledge. But it's the expectation that's going to make it happen. Things will happen. You'll read certain books. You'll meet certain people. Your thinking will go down certain paths. I mean, things will happen bit by bit that will lead you to wealth someday. See, it's all based on your expectations. I mean, the reason why more people aren't better off financially is because, well, they... They never expected to be better off, and they grew up in a family. Maybe, you know, I mean, her father made a medium average income, and their lifestyle was pretty middle class, and well, that's just what they expect, and so that's what they get. You see. I'm not saying there's a right and wrong here either. I'm not saying it's good to be wealthy and bad to be, not wealthy. I mean, I'm simply saying it's a choice. That's all. It's a choice. Not that one's better than the other, but, it's just a choice. Anyway, all that from consumer expectations. Consumer expectations is a powerful force when you're talking about demand curves. They can either shift to the right or shift to the left. Well, what does demographics mean? Demographics means environment. It means that in Florida, there tends to be a high demand for air conditioners, but a low demand for heaters. Whereas in Maine, there tends to be a low demand for air conditioners, but a high demand for heaters. You see what I mean? Why? Well, because the demographics of Florida is different than the demographics in Maine. And that's what we mean by demographics. And demographics determine demand for different things. Well, consumer tastes. Well, consumer tastes can change. And as they change tastes and preferences, then this will affect demand curves. Fads come and go, and certain style clothes comes into fad, and people tend to buy more of that. And others go out of style, and people tend to buy less of that. People prefer one thing over another. Music players. iPods have become very popular, but it's really there are other music players, right? But iPods are the most popular, but people buy iPods based on, their tastes and preferences, right? Or you might buy another audio player based on your tastes and preferences. Okay, so now we've done with demand, and what we're going to talk about now is the supply curve. So this is the middle part of the chapter. Now, here is the key when you're talking about demand and supply. You've got to have a split personality. When you're talking about the demand curve, you're talking about those who are doing the demanding. When you're looking at the supply curve, you're looking at those who are doing the supplying. Now, these are two completely different groups of people. Okay? Different groups of people. See, what we're going to find out here is that when the price goes up, the quantity supplied goes up. Now, before we get into anything else, how do we know that's true? How do we know that if the price goes up, the quantity supply goes up, and if the price goes down, the quantity supply goes down? But can you explain it? How do we know for certain that if the price goes up of anything, that the quantity supply will go up?
Persons become mobile into producing.
The what now?
Persons become mobile into supply goods.
More what?
Willing,
yeah. In other words, you're exactly right. The key word I like to use here is incentive. See, if you are the supplier of something, let's say you own a manufacturing company, and you're supplying something. If the price goes up for your product, now first of all, ultimately, is it you that is raising the price? No, it's not. What's causing the higher price? The market. See, you might decide on the initial price, but if you put something out there, let's say a new product, and you don't know what price to charge, and, well, you look at the petition and you look at your cost and you look at different things, but it really gets down to be just a guess. And so you say, well, this would be a good price for me to put in my product. If you happen to pick too high of a price, what's going to happen?
No one's going to buy your product.
Yeah, or few people will, right? You're not going to sell very much. And once you don't sell very much and you find that you've got a big warehouse here just chock full of your product that you can't sell and you've got all this money tied up in these things, what are you going to do to sell them?
Drop the price.
Drop the price. Now, what happens if you pick too low of a price?
Then you're going to lose money. You're not going to make any.
Well, you might make money. Well, we can't say that for sure. But if you charge too low of a price, then that means that people are going to buy it real quick and you're not going to have enough to sell everybody, and maybe you'll lose money because, well, you could have sold more, but you didn't have more to sell. See what I mean? So if you put something out there on the market and you charge and a whole bunch of people want it, and they say, oh, there's not enough here for everybody at the going price, so which ones of us are going to get? And those are thwarted. And in other words, the price mechanism kicks in here, right? And the highest bidder, people bid against one another, like in an auction, and the highest bidders are the ones who get. Well, what happens to the price? People bid the price up. So in other words, what determined the price of your product? The market. See, it wasn't you, it was the market. That's true with anything. Now, how do we know that if you put something out there in the market and the price goes up, how can we say 100% certain that you will make more money? Yeah, we can. How do we know? Huh? Well, yeah, you put something out there in the market and there's more of a demand. The price goes up, so we know, beyond a shadow of a doubt, 100% certain that you're going to make more money. How do we know that? Yeah, but how do we know you're going to make more profit? How do we know you're going to make more profit? Now, what I'm getting at is this. What I'm getting at is, what changed?
Just the price.
Now, when we change price, what do we always assume?
That there's an increase in.
No.
That there's a
we assume that nothing else changes. Everything else stays the same. Yeah, all else remains constant. So
therefore,
You're guaranteed to make more money, yeah. See, I mean, if the price of your product goes up, and that's the only thing that's happening here, your costs stay the same. You know, you see, everything stays the same. The only thing that's changing here is the price of your product's gone up. Well, what has got to happen? You got to make more money, correct? Now, we can only say that because we assumed that nothing else changed, because that's one of the rules of the game. Now, as a business person, see, a good business person is never into any one thing. In other words, a good business person isn't into the sporting goods industry because they like, you know, they like sports. Or they're not into the restaurant business because they just, you know, like restaurants. I mean, people do things like that, but a true business person is into anything that's a good deal. An entrepreneur is into anything that's a good vehicle. It doesn't make any difference what it is. If it's a good vehicle, that's what they're interested in. So in other words, if the price goes up, then there is an incentive for the entrepreneur to produce more of that thing because more money can be made. And they're making decisions based on self-motivation, self-interest, on profit, correct? And more entrepreneurs are going to flock to something where, you know, a lot of money's being made, and they're going to run away from places where
prices are going down and losses are being made. So I mean, so so we say here that is that as a supplier. Now you can only understand this if you leave the mindset of a consumer and you put yourself in the shoes of a supplier. See, these are two different people. Now, you know, for example, you all are the future suppliers of professionals, correct? I mean, why are you in college? Are you in college because once you get that degree, your ambition is to flip burgers at McDonald's? I mean, why are you in college?
So you can get a professional job.
A professional job, correct? Yeah, you make more money. I mean, there's lots of advantage here. So because that's your motivation, you are the future suppliers of accountants, teachers, right? Now, what happens if the wages of teachers goes down, but the wages, the income potential of accountants goes up? Exactly. More of you will make a decision to go into accounting. Why? Because as the price went up, the quantity supplied went up. See? Because more of you said, hey, I don't want to go into teaching and make, you know, a pittance. I would rather go into accounting and make a much higher income. Which, by the way, is exactly where you all are at this point, right? You all, I mean, this is a sophomore level course, correct? Now, by the time you're a junior, next semester, what are you going to do? You got to declare a major. I mean, you've had a free ride for two years. You know, you've had everything, I mean, everything was laid out for you. Well, you take a year of, English, and you take a year of biology, and you know what I mean? I mean, it's all kind of laid out for you. But by the time you're a junior, you can't do that anymore. You have to declare a major. Now, what's going to make what major are you going to declare? Well, there's lots of factors that will enter into it, but surely one of the factors is, I mean, when you graduate, do you want that degree to be worth something in the market?
Yeah.
Yes. You know, I have a son that he went to New River here, and then he transferred to UVA and University of Virginia and got a degree in history. Now you talk about one worthless degree. I mean, that was a worthless degree. That was just a waste of time. No, I mean, well, that's really my point. He didn't want to go into teaching, so...
What is he going to do?
Well, what he did, and this is several years ago, what he did is he came back to New River, and he got 3 degrees in the computer field, you know, and because, you know, we have a lot of courses in computers. And then he went to Radford University and got a degree in computer science, and today he's a computer programmer and makes a good living. And today...
He went to a good school like UVA.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's amazing, isn't it? And in fact, you know, he's got 3 degrees from New River, and he's got 1 degree from Radford, and then he's got his degree from UVA. And one day we're asking him, you know, well, you know, you think we should, you know, could hang up your degrees? You know, he wasn't even slightly concerned about his degree from UVA. That, I mean, to him, that had no value, because the only degrees that had any value was his New River degrees, and then the degree from Radford. Because those are the degrees that help them, you know, make a living. See what I mean? So you know, not all degrees are equal. And so what I'm saying is that this is a sophomore level course. By next semester, you've got to declare a major. And one of the factors is that, you want that degree to be worth something. And so you may have to make a decision to major in something that's, well, not your favorite, but it's maybe, you know, more marketable. You know, like I have a daughter that is a very verbal type person, you know, literary type person, but she got a degree in accounting. And then at 23, she got her CPA. And, I mean, she could have, I mean, no matter where she goes, she's got multitude of job offers. I mean, she can get a job anywhere. because that was a good, marketable degree. So I mean, now she would have maybe rather gone into, you know, English or something, but she said, you know, I want something this be worth my time. So she went into something that, well, it wasn't her favorite, but, you know, the degree ended up to be very, you know, very marketable. See? And because she could pick and choose, by the way, now that she's got two children, she could pick the job where it was closest to home. She walks to work, and she's got the exact hours. You know, she works only when her children are in school. So she can pick the job, and she pick her hours. Because why? Because she is in a commanding position. Her degree is worth a lot, and she's got lots of offers, and she can pick and choose. You see what I mean? So she chose not to get a high-paying job because she's not a professional person. She kind of rules, you know, the professional, work world. But, you know, at the same time, she does that fits her schedule. But she can only do that. She couldn't do that with some other degree that wasn't as marketable. I hope this helps somebody here. Well, marketing, maybe a business administration, economics, yeah. You know, is a good degree.
That's why you see a rise in people double majoring.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, I'm a double major.
Oh, yeah.
Minor,
yeah.
For that exact reason, to yeah. make sure I can get a job
yeah.
that pays what I want.
Yeah, you bet. Yeah, you double majors and you know, the sciences are, of course, good. You know, math is always a great. I mean, you have a math major, and there's all kinds of opportunities for math majors.
Yeah, I mean, like even in the textbook, they were going over the you know percentages of professionals between 35 and like 43, and what they were average paying in engineering for them. You know,
engineering
is the highest.
Yeah, engineering is good. You know, computer programming is good. The what?
Geology.
Really?
My brother graduated with a geology degree and got offered 5 jobs.
Wow, okay. Just recently?
Yeah, he's going to start in a week and a half.
Well, good. Well, great. Well, that's encouraging.
There's some courses like you have to take another language for it, but you take like an international business or something like that. My stepsister did that. She worked for some bank in Ghana. She actually
had
to move to Ghana.
Huh.
She worked there a lot.
But that's what she wanted to do, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Well, let me give you a tip. You know, here's what you ought to do, because this is the time in your life. You ought to go onto Monster Board, for example. There's other websites, but Monster Board's a good one, and play What If games. You know, Monster Board is a national website that publishes jobs. And you ought to play What If games. Like, what if I got a degree today in, you know, accounting, for example. Where would the jobs be, and what kind of jobs are they, and how much do they pay? Or what if I got a degree? So I mean, you can play what if games and find out for yourself, what would be a good degree to declare, because you're going to have to declare. You've got no choice. You're going to have to declare something next semester.
You can't get an undeclared degree.
Yeah, you can't get an undeclared degree. Exactly. Yeah. So, I got this class is over at 10:02, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's a little confusing for me because I teach Monday, Wednesdays, and they start at 1:25,
and then
until 1:45, and you all start at 1:30, but you're 5 minutes later anyway. I always got to think in my head, you know, which class I'm talking to. But anyway, all this was, I've given you the over. See, what is the purpose of my lectures over the textbook?
To give the overview.
Overview. Yeah, the details in the textbook. And that's really what I tried to do here with supply. You know, before we got into any of the, you know, the specifics, I was trying to give you, you know, the bigger picture. So you know the difference between supply and demand. So what is the supply curve? A relation showing the quantities of a good producers are willing and able to sell at various prices during a given time period, other things constant. Now, same definition as the demand curve, right? Except we're talking about supply and not demand. And the supply curve is just like with demand, showing the quantities of a good supply at various prices, other things constant. So there's no difference here. In terms of other things constant, change in price, we're moving along the curve. When price changes, the quantity supply changes, but not supply. Now, if supply were to change, what would have to happen? No, if supply were to change,
demand.
No, we're talking about supply. No, supply's got nothing to do with demand.
The price.
No, come on now. If supply is going to change, what? No.
The slope will go upward.
Come on now. It's the same as with demand. If supply changes,
everything is
opposite. No, the opposite. Something has to change other than price. If supply changes, something has to change other than price. See, when price changes, is there a change in supply? No. When price changes, there's a change in
demand.
No. The quantity supplied. Now, don't forget demand. Demand's got nothing to do with this, you see. We're talking about supply, and they're completely different. So when price changes, the quantity supply changes. Now, in order for supply to change, something
else
has to change. Well, we're gonna. That's in the next. You know, it's coming up in the next few slides. I've got 5 or 6 reasons that will show you things that will cause a shift in supply curves. Just like we, looked at those 6 reasons that will cause a shift in demand curves. Again, the law of supply says the price goes up, the quantity supply goes up. Now, again, that may not be true all the time, but it's true most of the time. And I just explained to you why, right? The key word here is what? I mean, in one word, why is it that when the price goes up, the quantity supply goes up? What's that one word? Incentive. Incentive. When the price goes up, the supplier has more incentive to supply, correct? Why? Because the supplier can make more money at the higher price, correct?
And that's assuming that everything else...
We always make that assumption when we change price. Now, a change in the quantity supplied is moving along the curve. I've talked about this. When price changes, we assume nothing else changes. We're moving along a curve. Price changes, change in the quantity supply. Here is a supply schedule shown to us on a table. Here's the supply curve showing us on a graph. And notice here, when price goes down, did supply go up or change? No. See, price went down. Anybody see supply change? No. What changed when price changed? Down on the horizontal axis, right? What changed down the horizontal axis was the quantity supplied. Whoops. When price went down, the quantity supplied what went down, right? And when the price would go up, the quantity supplied would go up. Why? Because incentive, right? If you're a supplier and the price goes down, you have a less incentive, correct? If you're a supplier and the price goes up, you have more incentive, right? All right, well, we just about run out of time here. So this is slide 34.